up. What would you think if God came to you and told you that he needed you to defend your faith in public 5 times over the next 2 years? Each time you were to defend your beliefs, it would be an audience of higher rank, and also one who ultimately could determine your fate. What would go through your mind? Well, that's exactly what Paul went through in Acts 22 through Acts 26, whereby he had to offer 5 separate defenses, each to audiences of greater power. And it's in Acts 22 that we witness Paul defending the way to the people of Jerusalem. Did we come up yet? Are we coming close? To do so, he tells of his birth, if you recall, his education, and the miraculous events involving his conversion. And the audience's response, remember what happened in Acts 22? We get a mob. They react violently, and even to the point where the chief captain involved actually had to take Paul physically and move him because he feared that that Paul would be torn from limb to limb. That the chief captain, if you remember by Acts 22, wound up taking him to a barracks, binding him, and then saying that he was going to rough him up. The language there indicates that he was going to be scourged. It's at that point that Paul offers information that obviously the chief captain didn't know. Paul says, well, I'm a Roman citizen. Is this how things work? And it's at that point that the chief captain goes, ooh, can't do this. Because he recognized that by taking such action with Paul, that he would then be held accountable. The captain then makes the next choice that is manifest, that takes place in Acts 23. And that is, he had to be taken, Paul, to the Sanhedrin next. So today we're going to spend some time on Acts 23, and we're going to see what we now see is Paul's second defense. Now remember, Acts 22 was his defense to those who happened to be in Jerusalem, or the term Jerusalemites, which I didn't know by language, but it indeed is accurate here. By background, if we kind of set the stage as we move through Luke 23 today, Luke is our author, we recall that, and we remain in 60 AD for Luke 21, chapter 22, and also Luke 23. In terms of location for chapter 23 of Luke, we're going to stay primarily in Jerusalem. And then further into this one chapter, we're going to see Paul taken elsewhere as he is prepped and moved for the next defense, that being over in Caesarea. So we're going to find ourselves there. If you take notes on what we do here from start to finish, Acts 23 really can be broken down 3 different ways. And if we're dealing with verses and sections of Scripture for Acts 23, Acts 23, verses 1 and 10 is where Paul is before the Sanhedrin. Section 2 is where Jewish plot, a group decide that they want to kill Paul. And that occurs between Acts 23, verse 11 through 22. And then lastly, we see Paul sent to Felix. And that happens in the last 10 or so verses, verses 23 to 25. And so what we're going to do here today is we're going to work our way through Acts 23, and it's what we oftentimes do. We're going to draw some lessons about what we find in Acts 23. That said, I'm going to start with, I'm heading for Acts, and you're already there. You got to jump on me. I'm going to start by reading Acts 23, and then we'll get some background about what is detailed here. What does the story tell us that we otherwise might not know in terms of further study? So we're in Acts 23, verse 1. Then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, said, "Men and brethren." Now we have to stop ourselves just briefly and ask, who are these men and brethren? And you probably have already tracked backwards a chapter or a verse to the previous chapter where it says, the next day he wanted to know for certain why, this happens to be the chief captain, why he was accused by the Jews, and he released him from his bonds and commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear. So he's giving us a nice tip-off here. He is saying that Paul next needs to go to the Sanhedrin. and brought Paul down and set him before them. So we're up to, again, 23 verse 1. Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. And let's read to 6 and then we'll backtrack. And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall, for you sit to judge me according to the law, and do you command me to be struck contrary to the law? And those who stood by said, do you revile God's high priest? Then Paul said, I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people. But when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council. And then he goes forward from there to make a statement. So if we're going to backtrack here, and if you will now bear with me, I'm going to play catch up on our slides. And they should work. And if not, I'm going to ask Mr. Ost to click. Will you click forward? Okay, so we're going to deal with Middle East today. This is oftentimes familiar land. We're going to stay right in here in terms of the Middle East. We go next. Click for me next, sir, if you will. This happens to be a map that shows we've already been through Paul's three primary journeys, and we're to a point here, and this is one of the reasons why I show this map, is in Acts 23, we start to get, if you remember in 22 and 21, we had indication that Paul was moved to go to Jerusalem. And we don't catch the end of the story until we get into 23, and about a third of the way through 23, we get an indication of what Paul began to see and understand that he was to do. So the aim here in terms of providing these journeys that are up here is to give you some sense of what took place previously, but also recognize that Paul is on this trip, and he understands this. And so he's going to touch upon this here. I'm going to go forward one more. For whatever reason, I'm not clicking. Would you click for me? So by map, you can keep clicking. In fact, you can click 3, if you will. Because we're going to get some arrows. We're going to start in Jerusalem. We're going to go a bit east and north, northeast. And then we're going to go up to Caesarea. So that's our path. Will you click again for me, Mr. Ost? Okay, Jerusalem is where we start. And you'll click again, Mr. Bryant. Okay, Paul and the Sanhedrin. Okay, so this is where we are. Now I'll stop here and go from here. Let's deal with the Sanhedrin, and that's what we're dealing with in verse 1. And I'm going to read briefly about from Holman's Bible Dictionary about the Sanhedrin. By background, this happens to be the individuals he's speaking to. The highest Jewish council in the first century, the council, the Sanhedrin, had 71 members and was presided over by the high priest. We see that referenced here. The Sanhedrin included both of the main Jewish parties among its membership, so Pharisees and Sadducees. Since the high priest presided, the Sadducee and priestly part seems to have predominated. But some leading Pharisees also were members. The word Sanhedrin is usually translated council in the English translations of the Bible. Now I'm going to drop down just a little bit in terms of the paragraph here. According to the Jewish tradition, the Sanhedrin began with the 70 elders appointed by Moses in Numbers 11, verse 16. You know, I didn't even think much about this, but this is where they find precedence. If you want to leave a marker here, flip with me, if you will, by background to Numbers. Numbers 11, this is where the Jewish people, the Pharisees and Sadducees became convinced that the Sanhedrin was indeed scriptural and endorsed by God. So Numbers 11:16. Now you remember by background here about the frustration. We saw this multiple times through the accounts of the Israelites in the Old Testament. But oftentimes Moses was frustrated by them. And so by background, Numbers 11 gives us voices, some of Moses' frustration. And we see that, you know, throughout here. In verse 16 where I'm going to ask you to read. So the Lord said to Moses, gather to me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be elders of the people and officers over them, bringing them to the tabernacle of meeting. that they may stand there with you. Then I will come down and talk with you there, and I will take of the Spirit that is upon you. Moses had God's Spirit, we're clear on that, and will put the same upon them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, that you may not bear it upon yourself. So one of the frustrations that Moses oftentimes had is he couldn't keep up with everyone. There were too many people for him to deal with in terms of judging, in terms of making decisions. And so here, as we read by background, and you may recall this story, here's where God designates 70. We know the notion or the number 70 has significance in a number of different ways. Verse 18, then you shall say to the people, sanctify yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat, for you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat? So they were complaining about meat. And if you want to continue to read this, and you can skim briefly here, I'm up to 21. He talks about 600,000 men on foot, yet you have said, I will give them meat. So they were complaining about meat. And if you go all the way up to 24, so Moses went out and told the people of the words of the Lord, and he gathered the 70 men of the elders of the people and placed them around the tabernacle. Now, interestingly enough here, this is where the Jewish people get the idea of a Sanhedrin. Okay, now I'm going to keep reading here. From Holman's Bible Dictionary. According to the Jewish tradition, the Sanhedrin began with the 70 elders appointed by Moses in Numbers 11:16 and was reorganized by Ezra after the exile. However, the Old Testament provides no evidence of a council that functioned like the Sanhedrin of later times. Thus, the Sanhedrin had its origin sometime during the centuries between the Testaments, between the Old and New Testament. During the first century, the Sanhedrin exerted authority under the watchful eye of the Romans. Generally, the Roman governor allowed the Sanhedrin considerable autonomy and authority. The trial of Jesus, however, shows that the Sanhedrin did not have the authority to condemn people to death. And I'm going to drop down and just read about three or four more sentences. The book of Acts describes how the Sanhedrin harassed and threatened the apostles. The healing of the men at the temple and Peter's sermon attracted the attention of the chief priests. Peter and John were called before the council and warned not to preach anymore in the name of Jesus. That happens in Acts 4. When the apostles continued to preach, the council had them arrested, and we see that in Acts 5. The wise counsel of Gamaliel caused the council to release the apostles with a beating and a warning. Stephen had to appear before the Sanhedrin on charges that sounded like the false charges against Jesus. And then, as we know, it wound up that Stephen was beaten. Now, I'm going to ask, as we add one more thing here, if Mr. Austin would click forward one more. Because I wanted to give you a visual about how this is. If we're dealing with 70 people, okay, which is what is established by the Sanhedrin. There were the 70 people a part of the Sanhedrin. And then, as you know, there's the high priest. So the high priest would roughly reside here. And then everyone would listen. And then the accused would be right here. So as we're thinking about this in your mind's eye, about what we're reading in Acts 23, that gives you some background here. So, again, in Acts 23, he begins, Paul, looking earnestly at the council. Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. He starts boldly. He was confident in what he says, and his words give indication that, as so many different translations indicate, is that he lived right with God. He had a clear conscience. Verse 2 then, reading again. And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Now, by background, Ananias happened to have been appointed by Herod. Josephus indicates that Ananias was really an unscrupulous person with violent tendencies. One reason that Ananias was actually killed years later is because it was well documented that he had gone to the temple and stolen tithe money. And the Jews didn't forget this, even to the extent that years later, during the Jewish insurrection, Ananias happened to have been killed by the Jews. Expositor's Greek Testament says that his death was involved him being dragged from a sewer where he happened to have been hid, and then he was killed by assassins who made it their business to use the exact weaponry that he oftentimes would charge to have inflicted upon Christians. So Ananias here commands that Paul be struck for speaking first. You know, it's really not clear why he does this. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown note that it's common even in the East today to silence a speaker by striking. But for a judge to treat a person on trial this way was really a character, a sense of how Ananias' character, or lack thereof, in terms of integrity, worked. Because he wasn't supposed to have him struck the way things work. In fact, Gill's exposition on the Bible actually offers this regarding why Ananias had him struck. First of all, he felt, more than likely, that Paul didn't take the time to flatter him. And as high priest, he had a big ego. And he was looking to be flattered. So he had him struck. The other thing, and the other reason that's offered here about why Paul might have been struck, or was told to be struck, was that Paul's strong declaration of innocence and spotless behavior tended to really get under Ananias' skin. And Ananias may have been convinced that the only way I humble this guy, because Paul was not hesitant at all here, the only way I humble this guy is to have someone strike him. So however this works, Paul's here and someone has to step out and hit him pretty hard so that he stops talking. Verse 3, then Paul said to him, God will strike you. Now notice his words here. God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. Wow, that's some heavy language, especially for a guy on trial. What he's really saying here is, despite the fact that everyone is in opposition around him, he's saying, you're a hypocrite. How dare you hit me? You know the law. Now, one of the things that's helpful for us to know is, again, the Sadducees and Pharisees were well-versed on the law. I'm going to go to Leviticus 19. And I'm just going to read something that they were to abide by. The high priest was responsible for following, and Paul knew this. Paul knew because he had been taught at Gamaliel, and he was well aware of his own rights, not only in the Jewish religion, but also from Roman citizenry. So if you're over in Leviticus 19, I'm only going to read two verses here, because both of them would be knowledgeable about what's involved here. Leviticus 19, verse 15 reads this way, you shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty, but in righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. You shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. Now, why would we reference this? Because Ananias knew this. And Paul knew this. And so this is why Paul says, you whitewashed wall, you big hypocrite. Going forward, for you sit to judge me according to the law, and do you command me to be struck contrary to the law? So he didn't do this. He knew he wasn't supposed to do this. Verse 4, and those who stood by said, do you revile God's high priest? Now, it's not really clear in terms of our interaction here why Paul, first of all, made his defense first. He certainly knew the law. And I imagine he had some latitude here thinking, I can defend myself first and then we'll go from there. And Ananias isn't going to have any part of that. But what we find here is that as Paul is standing there, Paul, for whatever reason, doesn't understand Ananias to be the high priest. Now, that's a partial explanation based upon some commentaries. And it may have been because, at the time, as a couple of different commentaries note, he may not have been wearing the formal wear of a high priest. The other thing that we know, and we see this, and I'll just make reference of it in Galatians 6, 11 through 15, is we also know that Paul had, more than likely, difficulty seeing. So he may not have been able to see who this was, depending on the situation. What we find here is that indeed Paul acknowledges his improper initial comments. Verse 5, then Paul said, I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people. So he, even here, Paul references the law to note that he was wrong. Verse 6, but when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out to the council. Now, this is actually a strategic move here. He's well aware that he can divide this council with certain statements. He also knows of what he believes to be the most pressing points that have to be gotten across in terms of his public defenses. So he's going to go at them here. He cried out in the council, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of the Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged." And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. Now, why was this divided? Well, he recognizes here that the Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection. The Pharisees did. Remember my background here? So what he was doing is he was going to create a stir, knowing this. But he also does so very purposefully for this reason. Because he knows that in this public defense, he needs to address the resurrection. And to do so, to address the resurrection, by implication, is linked to the importance of Christ's role in salvation for everyone. And so he wants to connect them all here. You know, I'm only going to note something here. This thought process that Paul demonstrates here is really complex and thorough. I don't know if you recall the book, and I had a student who quoted it to me the other day, Stephen Covey, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. One of the points that Covey brings up is to begin with the end in mind. And if you've read that book, you probably remember this principle. One of the things that Paul is doing here is, remember, Paul was moved by the Spirit to go to Jerusalem. He also knew, and we'll see further down here, that there was a much larger task at hand, that he was to defend the faith, the way, multiple times before he died. I won't have you turn there, but you can go over to Acts 27, verse 1, and Acts 28, verse 16, and see here where Paul speaks of the realization that he was eventually to go to the highest level in terms of proclaiming an understanding of God and his calling. And he knew this as he was speaking. So if you go there and at least get a sense of what Paul's comments are there, Paul really began with the end in mind. He did this in order to address the role and importance of the resurrection, but as well, equally so, if not more important, Christ's role in the plan of salvation. You're not going to necessarily separate those. Verse 7. "And when he had said this, a dissension arose among the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees said that there is no resurrection and no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. Then there rose a loud outcry, and the scribes who were of the Pharisees' party arose and protested, saying, 'We find no evil in this man. But if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God.' And when there arose a great dissension, the commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces," wow, he's in trouble again by them, "commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring them into the barracks." So what we see here repeatedly is Paul continually is taken out so that he's not killed. You know, in addition to the Pharisees believing in the resurrection, they also believed in the angels or spirits. And so they were really getting under the skin of the Sadducees here. But what we find here in 10 is indeed another mob occurs. Verse 11, But the following night, the Lord stood by him and said, now if you have red letter edition, you know that Jesus Christ's words are offered here. "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome." You know, God speaks directly here with Paul, and he provides encouragement. So this takes us to section 2, the plot against Paul. And we'll go forward from here in verse 12. "And when it was day, some of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul." So they came together and said, "This is it. We're not taking any more. We're going to all form an oath together so that we take him out." Verse 30. Now there were more than 40 who had formed this conspiracy. They came to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a great oath that we will eat nothing until we have killed Paul." You know, at the time, an oath was an important point in Jewish law, as it probably should be today with all of us. We should watch what we promise. In a case like this, though, they took an oath to kill Paul, and that oath was, "We will not eat until we kill him." Now, interestingly enough, at the time, the Jews knew that certain vows could be broken. In fact, by law, there were actually four ways to violate a vow justifiably. There was the vow of incitement, and this meaning that an act or an action or provoking of unlawful behavior would allow you out of a vow. There was vows of exaggeration. If you committed to too much, you could get out of a vow. There were vows of error. In other words, I made a mistake in making the vow. And then there were vows that could not be fulfilled by reason of constraint. For whatever reason, your situation did not allow you to fulfill the vow. Now, interestingly enough, this 40-plus individuals decide, we're going to form a vow and we won't eat until we kill him. They did this knowing, despite the fact this seemingly has teeth, they did this knowing that they could back their way out of a vow at any time. And indeed, that's what we actually see happen. Verse 15, now you therefore, together with the council, suggest to the commander that he be brought down to you tomorrow as though you were going to make further inquiries concerning him. But we are ready to kill him before he comes near. And when Paul's sister's son heard of their ambush, he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Now, we wind up seeing a number of things here. One is, we know Paul's nephew hears this. We figure out here that Paul actually has siblings. We don't know that otherwise. In fact, it doesn't show up anywhere else in God's Word. We know that he has a sister here, and we know he has a sibling. It's the only time we see this anywhere in Scripture. However, his nephew hears this, he has to be around close enough to hear these things. Now, we don't know if it's by word of mouth that gets out from this Jewish group that decides to kill Paul, or whether it had already traveled through Jerusalem in a section of the city. We don't know that. But we know one way or another that indeed this little nephew finds this out. This nephew then goes to Paul and tells him what's going to happen. You're going to be killed by these 40-plus guys. Verse 17, then Paul called one of the centurions, a soldier, to him and said, take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him. Go tell the commander this story. So he took him and brought him to the commander and said, Paul, the prisoner called me to him and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say to you. Now, by background here, this whole notion of custody that we see kind of play out in these number of verses, custody tended to be one of three types at the time of the Romans. There was public custody, where you were oftentimes jailed or you were in a dungeon. There was house arrest. We oftentimes speak of this even today, where you have to remain at home. And then there's military custody, and this happens to be where a prisoner's left hand was chained to a soldier's right hand and you were kept at home. We actually see Paul do this later on. In Acts 28, 17 through 20. So we see these different types of custodies being dealt with, these arrests. Verse 18 then, we see that the nephew is allowed to speak. So he took him, brought him to this. 19, the commander took him by the hand. Now this gives an indication of age. This couldn't have been that old a young little guy, because the commander does two things. First of all, he takes this little guy, this nephew, by the hand. And generally, we would only find that acceptable, even culturally at the time, by someone who happened to be younger. And he takes this little guy away from everyone in order to obtain the information. So this commander happens to be adept at what he's doing. Verse 19, then the commander took him by the hand, went aside, and asked him privately, what is it that you have to tell me? And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask that you bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire more fully about him. But do not yield to them, for more than 40 of them lie in wait for him, men who have bound themselves by the oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for the promise from you. So they were all laying wait. Verse 22, so the commander let the young man depart and commanded him, tell no one that you have revealed these things to me. So as we see here, the commander then decides, based upon this information, he realizes this is too big a deal. He actually recognizes that if Paul is torn asunder again as a Roman citizen, that he would be responsible again. So the commander tends to think, oh, I got to go up the line. This has to go to Felix, which happens to be in Judea. And so that's what we see here as we enter this or finish this second section, which takes us to the third section of Acts 23. Paul is sent to Felix. Verse 23, and he called for two centurions, saying, prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at the third hour of the night, and provide mounts to set Paul on, and bring him safely to Felix the governor. So recognizing that he has 40 plus guys who are coming after him, how many individuals, and this kind of reminds me of how many soldiers does it take to screw in a light bulb? How many individuals does it take to get Paul to Felix? And I've got a hand up, 470. He has 470 different men. Boy, he really thought a lot about protecting Paul here. Now that's separate from, and we see spearmen here, we see those who happen to be on horseback, and then we also see Paul on horseback. What we get here is we don't get just a few guys who take Paul, who are taking Paul to Felix. We see pretty much an army taking Paul to Felix. And by many commentaries, it would indicate that he would have been placed in the middle and they would have had protection completely around him. Now, Paul probably had an idea of this is how things work. And he knew of the inevitability of this. So as we read in verse 23, this took place at the third hour. This would be around 9 p.m. at night. Verse 24, and provide mounts to set Paul on to bring him safely to Felix the governor. Now Felix happened to be termed Antonius Felix. He was governor of Judea. Would you guys click for me over there? Click, click. Okay, so we're here. Can you click again for me? Please. So here's Antipatris. And as we'll read here, this is the path that they wind up going. This is what Antipatris looks like. Go back for me, if you will, one. What you're going to find here is what they were thinking through. I got to find Jerusalem's here. What they were thinking through, the soldiers, is we're not going to go from here to here because those 40 plus will lie in wait somewhere along this path. So what we're going to do is we're going to go by night cover, and we're going to go all the way over here, and then we're going to slide all the way up the coast. That's what they figured out would be safest. Now, the terrain itself made it even more difficult for people to track them. So they were well-equipped, and they moved out at night. Tacitus says he governed, this being Felix, that he governed with the authority of a king and the baseness and insolence of a slave. He was an unrighteous governor, a base mercenary and bad man, Clark's commentary notes. So that gives you an idea of where we're headed for Felix. Verse 25, he wrote a letter in the following manner. So again, we're dealing with, by background, the commander writing this letter. He wrote a letter in the following manner. Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before the council. And I found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him worthy of death or chains. And when it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for him, or for the man, I sent him immediately to you, and also commanded his accusers to stay before you the charges, against him. Farewell. Now, as we kind of get a sense here, the letter is well crafted. The commander is writes this letter with the aim of it getting to Felix. If you note something here, what did the commander leave out? Remember any of the background here? The commander was the one who bound him and pretty much said that he was going to whip him. Okay? Did he write that in the letter? No, that one seemed to have been omitted. So he was selective here. As we go back, can you go back one for me? Oh, go forward two. Thank you, sir. If you look here, there were traces, one commentary notes this, traces of Roman roads have been discovered between these locations on the map. Having started probably at about midnight, they would have reached town about 6 or 7 a.m. They would then be beyond all danger of pursuit or attack, and the foot soldiers therefore would have returned as no longer needed to the barracks back in Jerusalem, leaving the horsemen to go on. So that gives us some idea of where they were going. So then, going through our letter, I'm going to ask you to click forward if you will. This is Antipatris. Would you click forward again? And we're going to make our way up to Caesarea. Will you click for me again? Click one more, sir. Remember what Caesarea looks like? This gives you some idea of where they were headed, where Felix would reside. Click one more. These are actually excavations. We know that Caesarea looks this way even today. And one more, I'm going to give you a graphic. This is what it would have looked at like at the time they were taking Paul. So this is where they were headed. Verse 30, then the soldiers, as they were commanded, verse 31, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. The next day they left the horsemen to go on with him and returned to the barracks. And when they came to Caesarea and had delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. The last two verses then of 23 read this way, and when the governor had read it, he asked what province he was from. Now, why would he do that? Because in Roman law, there was an issue of jurisdiction here. Did he have the ability to make a decision on this? And when he had understood that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will hear you when your accusers also have come. And he came, and he commanded him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. So what we see here again as we go to the end of 23 is we see the anticipation of a third defense. So we might ask ourselves, what might we take here? And I'm going to offer just two lessons that we might take from this section of Scripture. The first one comes from Acts 23, verse 3. Acts 23, verse 3 reads this way, where God talked about... we see an example of Ananias in bad judgment, and we see this juxtaposed or in contrast to what God expects from you and me. Matthew 7. My lesson here is entitled, Right Judgment is a Key Quality of God's People. Matthew 7. I'm going to go have us read just two scriptures about the lesson that we can learn from these scriptures. Matthew 7. Verses 1 through 5, Matthew 7, verses 1 through 5. Right judgment is a key quality of God's people. It reads this way, and again, we're contrasting the Ananias' approach versus what you and I are to have as judges. Matthew 7, verse 1. Judge not that you be not judged, for with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the same measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck out of your eye, and look, a plank is in your eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck out of your brother's eye. Now this links well with, I'm going to go forward to Matthew 7, and we'll read just five, six verses here. Did I say Matthew 7? I meant John 7. Forgive me. You're going to go forward with me. John 7, verse 45. John 7, verse 45. Here's the Sanhedrin in action, much like we had a chance to see in Acts 23. John 7, verse 45 reads this way, then the officers came to the chief in their dealing with Christ, came to the chief priests and Pharisees who said to him, why have you brought him? Verse 46, and officers answered, no man ever spoke like this man. And the Pharisees answered them and said, are you also deceived? Have any of the rulers of the Pharisees believed in him? But this crowd that does not know the law is accursed. Nicodemus, he who came to Jesus by night, being one of them, said to them, does our law judge a man before it hears him and knows what he is doing? So the point I'm making here is, as we see from Ananias, is Ananias was judgmental. Ananias, in terms of having Paul slapped, hit, in order to humble him, and in violation of the law, was showing us improper judgment, poor judgment. And you and I are to have the opposite. We are to have right judgment. The second lesson that we might take from Acts 23 shows up in verse 11. And it's along the lines of seeing Jesus Christ's words here and the encouragement that Jesus Christ provides. I offer this lesson. God is always there to encourage you and me. God is always there to encourage you and me. James 1. You know, sometimes we will go through life and we will feel like God doesn't see anything. God can't be seeing this. There's no way he sees this. This is too bad. Obviously, God has gone somewhere else and he's not paying attention to what I'm going through. And what we see here in James 1, if you're reminded here of what happens in the first couple of verses of James 1, James, a servant of God and the Lord, and of the Lord Jesus Christ, if you drop to verse 2, it reads this way. And these are sometimes hard words to swallow. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. I don't know about you, but the last thing I think about when I'm in the middle of a trial is joy. I've got big joy going here. Most of the time, I'm usually overwhelmed by it. I'm thinking to myself, what have I done wrong? How did I get to this point? Why is this coming up? I certainly don't count it as joy most of the time. And yet what James is inspired to write here is indeed that we are to count it joy when we fall into trials. For what reason? 3, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. And then we see all these items here that as they go forward, but let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing, that you may be mature. That's what the aim here is of these trials. So as we see here, even if we're thinking about the context of what Paul is going through. I mean, Paul, if we look at, if I think of my own life, and I think about the things I go through, if I think about the things we go through as a family, if I think about, if I get real personal, even what Sarah is going through, and I think about all of these things, do I count it joy that all of these things happen? No. Does it give you and me opportunity to really bear down, to draw closer to God, to build character so that we might be patient and that we might, as noted here in verse 5, that we might be more complete, more mature, lacking nothing? That's what we're supposed to think. I'll read one more verse on this lesson, John 14. John 14, verse 23, and we'll read several verses that then continue here. John 14, verse 23, Judas, I'll start in 22, not Iscariot, said to him, Lord, how is it that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world? We read this oftentimes around the spring holy days. In fact, the Passover, this is when we read this. Jesus answered and said to him, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and he will come to him and make our home with him. He who does not love me does not keep my words, and the words which you hear is not mine, but the Father's who sent me. These things I have spoken to you while being present with you, but the Helper, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, he will teach you all things and bring you to remembrance all things that I said to you. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you, not as the world gives, do I give to you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. You have heard me say to you, I am going away and coming back to you. If you love me, you would rejoice, because I said I am going to the Father, for my Father is greater than I. And now I have told you before it comes, that when it comes, when it does come to pass, you may believe. I will no longer talk much with you, for the ruler of this world is coming, and he has nothing in me. But that the world may know that I love the Father, and as the Father gave me commandment, so I do. Arise, let us go from here. Now we know by background what happens here shortly. Christ is crucified. He uses the phrase here, uses the term here, even if as you recall reading, he used the term here about joy. But what does he say? He said, as you go through your own trials in life, as you go through your struggles, no matter how hard you think they are, rejoice. I'm working with you. Put your name in the blank here. I'm working with you through these trials. This is how I forge. Remember the hands that oftentimes we used to sometimes tease about taking coal and pressing it hard so you get a diamond? God is pushing down and pressing on you so that he gets a diamond out of you. It doesn't happen by taking a carnival cruise, eating off the buffet all the time, until we pass out. That's not how this works. Okay? The way it works is God's going to give you opportunity to get stronger, characterized. Me opportunity to go through trials. And then he gives you and me opportunity to make a choice. And our choice is to draw closer to him to connect with Him, and He promises, if we'll rely on Him and we'll allow His Spirit to be stirred up in us, that we will be encouraged from this process. So God is always there to encourage us. There are two simple lessons, but certainly they're helpful for any of us to look at and consider as we go through Acts 23. You know, what would you think if God came to you and told you that He needed you to defend His truth 5 times in the near future? He's going to put you in front of different audiences, each of greater power, with an ability to evaluate you. You know, in a way, God has done this. I'm going to quote 1 Peter 3:15 through 17. It reads this way. But in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience, so that those who speak maliciously against you and against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of slander. For it is better, if it is God's will, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. God has given you, He's given me, opportunity to provide a defense to those people we come in contact with. He's also given us the opportunity to have His Spirit so that we're encouraged by the process. In Acts 23, we see by way of Paul how to defend the faith. Let's not take lightly the opportunity that God's given us and the example set by Paul, and especially by Jesus Christ, to defend our faith when given the chance.